Good evening.
Good evening.
So today we are finally getting to the very end of the book, Natural Wakefulness. The main topic of the book, which we've already covered completely up to now, is what's called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. And they are the mindfulness of body, mindfulness of feeling, mindfulness of mind, and mindfulness of sense fields. So the question is, why are there two extra chapters there? And I'm not sure. I did not ask Galen Ferguson. I did tell him we're using this book, but I didn't ask him this question. So what I feel this is about is the topic called the Four Foundations of Mindfulness lies within our Shamatha Vipassana practice. It's about our practice. And after the practice, we then say, how can we bring it out into the world as compassion and benefit for others? Now, the way we've been teaching here, we actually started with that, and then we came back to dealing with mindfulness practice itself. So when I look at these two chapters, I see something which Galen didn't exactly say, but what I see is that they're about poverty and wealth. The first one, awakening from the nightmare of materialism, is about poverty. And the second one, called Awakening Communities of Courage, is about wealth, as I see it. So I'll try to cast it in that form, poverty and wealth. And that's why this paper has two sides, by the way. So, awakening from the nightmare of materialism. This actually begins with a quote. It's a one-line quote. But I'm going to quote you a little more around it so you can see what it's about. And by the way, this comes from the sadhana of Mahamudra, which Emily mentioned earlier. The tradition of meditation is waning and we are drunk with spiritual pride and seduced by passion. The Dharma is used for material gain and the river of materialism has burst its banks. The materialistic outlook dominates everywhere and the mind is intoxicated with worldly concerns. I don't feel like interpreting that, but you can see that it's both intense and rather poetic and very intensely felt. Trungpa Rinpoche talked a great deal about the three lords of materialism. And the word Lord here is used in a rather unusual sense. It's not like the Lord of the Manor, some very benevolent Lord. Rather, it means a tyrannical Lord who keeps us in slavery. The Tibetan word is either Lalo or Gyalgong. I think it's Lalo. And it means a barbarian king, one whose sense of values is perverted but nevertheless has power. So what you'll find in this chapter, and we're going to follow the chapter quite precisely actually, is the three lords are called the Lord of Form or Body, the Lord of Speech, and the Lord of Mind. And there's another way to talk about it since we are using the word materialism. The Lord of Form could be called material materialism. The Lord of Speech could be called psychological materialism. And the Lord of Mind could be called spiritual materialism. And since there's a lot of vocabulary there, I thought you ought to have it right in front of you. This is a very important point that Trungpa Rinpoche made. In fact, he even wrote a book called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism because he found this was so important for his students to hear, and more than hear, to understand and contemplate deeply. So he wrote a whole book about this, interestingly. So we're actually going to follow the text for a little while, starting on page 145. So could I have a volunteer actually to read that, starting on the bottom of 145 and finishing that paragraph on the next page?
Lord of Form?
Yeah, Lord of Form. Loudly. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
The Lord of Form includes our relationship to our bodies as well as to the body or form of the world around us. As Trungpa Rinpoche explained, the Lord of Form refers to the neurotic pursuit of physical comfort, security, and pleasure, our preoccupation with manipulating physical surroundings. Be careful here. It's not the physical world itself, but the psychological clinging that so quickly turns things sour, polluted, stagnant. It is this clinging attitude that drives us, motivates us to try to control the natural world.
Does that make sense to people, what it's about?
The natural world meaning nature or the world around us?
Good question. All of it.
All of it.
All of the above, yes. Everything we could possibly include, whether it's mountains and valleys or the atmosphere,
Or the building we're in.
Or detergent which we use to wash our dishes, or pencils which we need to sharpen, it's not meant to exclude anything in the physical universe by any means. So there are a couple of other little things that Galen says here. It includes all our efforts to completely control our bodies, through physical fitness, biomedicine, cosmetic surgery. These are all signs of the basic anxiety about physical form, which doesn't mean we shouldn't try to be physically fit. Again, it's our anxiety or attachment which is the issue. The good news is that it's possible to enjoy our bodies in the physical world without the grasping and fixation that often imprisons us in worry and anxiety. So, what does that mean? Anyone want to... I want to give people a chance to say what's on their mind, what the problem is.
Can you say that one more time?
What do you want me to...
With the reading you just said.
Okay, I was just reading from the book. The good news is that it's possible to enjoy our bodies and the physical world, and that includes any kind of luxury, without the grasping and fixation that often imprisons us in worry and anxiety.
It's just saying that it's possible to learn to just be and accept who we are and not looking to appear a certain way or strive for this idealism that might be impossible to find.
Yeah. Good.
I think it's kind of like thinking of, like, today was a nice day, I could go for a walk. And it's nice that today I feel okay, and I have a reasonably pleasant place to walk around in. But it'll be okay if tomorrow, you know, next week I don't feel so well and it's raining. My life won't be terrible because I can't do that next week. I can have the pleasure now, and next week I'll do something else, but not.
Or to not let these things form our identity, these material things, to have them and or appreciate them for whatever they are, but be enough without them.
Right. Okay, very good.
And I think that, you know, a lot of the health information and some of these other things can make us a little obsessive about this odd little quirky pain. Is that what is is that a symptom that I'm going to die tomorrow? You know, some of, and we overreact to some of those kinds. And how do we get that balance of taking seriously what needs to be taken seriously without scaring ourselves?
Yeah, good.
And also, it just seems like my understanding is that just, you know, the anxiety goes around and perpetuates things that put you on this roller coaster ride, you know, that brings you out of being in the being of the moment.
Yeah, when we have a word for this roller coaster ride, what is it? What?
Samsara.
Yeah.
Samsara.
Yes.
You asked me once, Gary, about that word, samsara.
Yeah.
It's on our dedication to Mary. It's that the circle that goes around and around.
Yeah.
A circle of suffering.
The Tibetan word for it, interestingly, is korwa. And kor is a word having to do with circulating. Mm-hmm. So it's the recycling of suffering is samsara.
It makes me think of kind of children's no big deal. Like, especially when we're talking about material things, you know, we have all these material choices. Like you mentioned detergent and all these things, you know, it's, you don't need to get hung up on it. Mm-hmm. It's not such a lot of this stuff is not such a big deal. Mm-hmm. And not, it's not worth the attention or the anxiety that we put mm-hmm. into so many choices. But I think your point about knowing what you need to really, when you need to make an important decision, especially when it comes to health, that's a little different. But sorting that all out is really...
Yeah, because if you read the web pages, they all say, see, medical attention immediately.
There are times where... But especially in relation to the material things around us and that we use and we think we need or want, it's not such a big deal. Yeah.
Well, we're also in a culture where we're sold something constantly. We're
right.
always being, we're always seeing advertising, and it's very hard not to be influenced by
right.
that, you know. Mm-hmm. My body isn't quite the right shape, you know, too many pounds here. Need a better nose, you know, you mentioned that. You know, it's like, whoa, it becomes this obsession of, and, you know, you could just start believing in all of that, and that's a very materialistic view. Because how is it really going to make you better or change your life, really?
Mm-hmm.
It's there's some deception there, I think.
And I think a lot of that materialism is sort of the samsara is, if I could get to some portion of physical ideal, whether it was owning the right things or mm-hmm. having my body look this certain way or eating the right foods exactly right, then everything would be great. I would continue, I would just be in bliss all the time.
Yeah.
Right. I wouldn't even need to go to meditation group because I'd be so happy.
Right. It ultimately goes even further than that because I can't hold on to this body. It's going to die. So genuine equanimity is we have tremendous enjoyment of our body and we still have to let go of it.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately that's going to be, can we give that up without fear and panic?
Mm-hmm.
at the right time. It's a little harder, but that's included. Because we do have to do it.
It's harder to give up the people you love.
And that's even, yeah, that can be harder than your own death, yes.
For me, it's a struggle to be free from those obsessions about, I'm too this, I'm too that, and then if I work on this or that, then and I get maybe to a little piece where I like to be, then I'm worrying about, then I start worrying about this other thing, because then that the other thing isn't quite good enough either. So it's always a struggle, and it's in meditation being free from those thoughts and being focused on my breath. And when I can get into those moments, even if it's just a moment, it just feels so freeing. Even if it's just for, even if I just get a glimpse of it and it's gone, but it's like, oh, there it is. It's such a struggle.
There's another side to it that, yes, it's we don't want to or don't want to get sort of obsessed with all of these things. Yet I don't want to go so far with that. That I'm feeling, that I feel scorn at people who do obsess about material things and feel a haughty superiority to them. Mm-hmm. And I have to be careful that I don't go off in that direction either.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So now we have to go on to the next word then. Okay, what about the Lord of Speech? Someone want to read the first paragraph of that? Bottom of page 146. Who's going to read it? Are you going to read it? Okay.
The Lord of Speech. Similarly, the Lord of Speech doesn't mean the ideas and categories that we all use to make the sense of our lives, the speech that we use to communicate. Again, what's meant is the neurotic use of concepts as filters to screen us from a direct perception of what is, as from Shedro. We use sets of ideas, systems of ideology, to reinforce a sense of solid personal identity. When I first read these teachings, I was struck that Trungpa Rinpoche specifically mentions nationalism, Christianity, Buddhism. Now we should continue by adding our favorite belief systems to the list, all the ideas we cling to.
Very good, thank you. So this is not against intellect. It's not against all the very complicated ideas that we need to apply to our world, whether they belong in the political realm of figuring your income tax or doing calculus or working out personal relations. It's not against ideas, so what is it he's talking about? The realm of speech includes intellect, by the way. Yeah.
Belief systems. Environmentalism?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. Depending on how you use it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all of your isms?
Mm-hmm. What about intersubjectivity?
Pardon?
What about, like, intersubjectivity? How a bunch of people can agree on something, but that doesn't make it any truer than otherwise.
Okay. Okay.
Agreed.
So.
Sort of like groupthink.
Yeah.
Or consensus reality.
Well. Okay. Let's try to
see what he said.
Try to clarify that.
Well, that's the
put a knife around
belief
it. Yeah.
Systems, right? Sort of regimentation of thought, discipline, and how that kind of ties into systems of power and ultimately, you know, materialism.
Okay, so since I am going to be talking about ecology later, what is the misuse of that?
Of ecology?
Well, the idea of ecology.
By whose standard?
What?
By whose standard?
No, it's not about...
I'm not sure I understand what you're saying.
What would the example of the Lord of Speech be? In other words, the misuse of a conceptual framework. Not the framework itself. It's the same thing as material things, right? It's not the material that's wrong. It's the building of an identity about it.
It's a rigidity.
Yeah.
Oppression from the people of another, another group of people.
I think also things, I mean, from this I would think group environmental groups that go out and hurt other people and damage other people's stuff, they're sort of stuck on like what I'm, when you get stuck on the idea that I know what's right and I'm going to do what's right without consideration for other people.
Yeah, and there's also many people, there are trade-offs in the environmental world, or not maybe not trade-offs, but people may have land that they want, they've been doing something with that maybe isn't ideal, but it's going to cause them real economic hardship to stop. There's some people in any movement are very self-righteous. It's not just the violence, it's the...
The affirmation. Just sort of like using intellect to just affirm whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's that, but it's also... I'm going to use a slightly different example of maybe new environmental regulations are going to put this whole industry out of business, and all these people are going to lose their jobs and they're terrified. And if you are just saying we have to clean the environment without making an awareness of what you're doing and trying to help ameliorate the changes that need to be made to solve one problem, want to create another. I don't know.
Okay, but that's in the realm of perhaps making a bad decision.
Is it? Okay. But there's a self-righteousness in it.
There's a self-righteousness, so what is the essence of that? Again, everything here has to do with ego.
It's a tightness.
At all three levels, yeah. Tightness.
Uh-huh. My way is the best way.
Yeah.
Always.
I know what's best.
Yeah. Even more fundamentally,
There's an I here who's going to know the right thing.
Right.
And that I is never going to change. It's always going to be the right person.
Mm-hmm. And you can manipulate science or history or whatever to confirm that for you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But and that brings other people into it.
That being stuck on that I.
Yeah.
I know, and the other part is then I can't then change because that's who I am.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like we got to the core of it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Galen says, so the nightmare of materialism... I jumped ahead. So he includes fixed ideas from psychology about who we really are. For instance, I am this kind of person with this kind of problem because of what my parents did. They did not do.
Yeah, it's all their fault.
I am a fucked up person because of what they did. Or I'm a wonderful person because of what they did. It doesn't matter.
It's interesting because it's so easy, just to fall back on, it worked for me. I mean, I'm not that crazy, but I'm still here, right? Opposed to, maybe that wasn't the best thing that they did. Maybe I can have a choice to to, you know, chart a new course that is right, opposed to, oh, well, that's, I'm just going to go with what I've always learned or what's ever been passed down on to me.
As soon as we get our identity into something, then we start. Hello. Okay, I'm this kind of person. I hate those on the other side with those stupid, evil ideas. So, I think we've got some handle on that. Shall we go on?
Well, I just have to say that yes. I feel it's always interesting that the body comes first and then we're talking about the mind, or, you know, ideology and thought and psychology. And I think that it's very slippery. I think it takes a lot of attentiveness to, like, be able to be witness to the repetition of, you know, the ideology, you know, even if it's a bad habit, a thought, and then courageously invite it to move on. Should it be the time?
Yeah, that's very important.
Yeah.
And as we go through the three Lloyds, we're getting more subtle. Okay? For instance, if one's a plain materialist and you've never thought about, I don't want to have anything to do with spiritual things. I have to earn my living. I enjoy my luxuries. And that's it. Okay? Now, that person is not going to have a problem with spiritual materialism, for example, which is the next one. It's us, by the way, who have that problem. you see? So that's the more subtle one. We came here, we want to attain some sort of spirituality. We want to be enlightened, I hope we do. We're the ones who could make this mistake. The plain materialist doesn't. He doesn't get anywhere near this realm. So the Lord of... Should we go on with you?
Yeah.
Okay. The Lord of mind is a way of describing the tendency to hold on to special, higher, or altered states of consciousness as a means of proving one's worth. Never mind, I'm not even concerned about these ideas and all that. What I really want is enlightenment, a more compassionate heart. I want awakening. So the nightmare of materialism, for example, my practice, my teacher, my lineage are superior to yours. We've got so much more egolessness.
Egolessness. Yeah. We're better than you because we have less ego. Yeah.
Okay, so this is rather subtle.
Our team has less ego.
What does it?
Our team, when you cheer, like our team is this.
Our team, okay. Rah, rah. So the nightmare of materialism, getting back to the topic, the title of the chapter, does have to do with consumerism. How much are we moved to buy and acquire more things in a desperate attempt to bring more solidity to our sense of self? Self, to try to fill an inner emptiness. Consumerism is a spiritual issue. But again, that can be on all different levels. It could be manipulation into feeling we need a new yacht, or we need a more educated view so that we have a better psychological understanding than someone else. And then finally, we can be treating our spiritual path as consumerism. And we do. And we cannot avoid it. So what we have to do is be aware of it continuously and uproot it when we see it. So how are they all connected? Again, consumerism is based on the same sense of basic lack. It means we don't feel we're already whole and complete. We need something. Either we need a material fix, or a psychological fix, or a spiritual fix, because we're not really content just to be who we are.
Sort of like a lot of when we're being sold stuff, the way we're sold is you could be better.
Which is really saying you're not enough.
Yeah, you're not enough. You could be better. You could have nicer hair or a better couch or a smarter brain.
Spiritual.
Smarter brain or be a more spiritually enlightened person, because right now you're not that good.
You could be one of the sort of superior people who know they need a Lexus.
You know, but it's interesting, the whole thing, you know, like, and maybe that's the reason why I'm here, is just, you know, to feel more whole, because I think, you know, when you think of, you know, whatever happened in your life, you know, whatever you didn't get enough of, or, you know, love or attention or material things or whatever, there's all these holes that are here that exist, that we perceive that exist, and the reason that we're here is to try to get a better understanding to it, that we, you know, that yes, we maybe had those things, but we are whole, and that we are capable of wholeness and goodness.
And that comes over time, yeah, and working with it. It's not so easy. So I put some questions at the bottom of page first side, and I think maybe we've run. I kind of think we've been talking about all of them all along, but if anyone has something more to say, we can deal with these are any other questions that you think I didn't put there.
I think it's interesting, this question, why is it based on the need for entertainment?
Ah, that's a good one, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
We haven't talked specifically about entertainment. Anyone want to, what do you have in your mind?
Well, I mean, entertainment as being something that will distract myself, that will take me out of myself, that will perhaps for a brief flickering moment or 2 hours or whatever, I can forget about whatever it is that I'm it's a nice distraction.
Yeah, I know.
It's
my
not
son,
a bad
yeah.
thing. It just is.
Well, my son has withdrawal symptoms if he has to if he's not working and he has to be without his iPhone for 5 minutes, he can't text or he can't YouTube. Starts the show very fast.
What do you mean by why does it all come from a sense of poverty?
Poverty, okay, yeah.
Well, not we're not enough.
Oh, that kind of.
Yeah, that I don't have.
Uh-huh.
I am not enough. I don't have enough. If I only had more, I could be.
Or what I have would be taken away from me.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
But I wonder, for people who are truly poor and lacking, how you know, you almost think it's really hard when you are struggling to make ends meet and to get by and to get food and health care and shelter, that it's a luxury to do something like we're doing tonight.
It is, yeah. So I don't think we're trying to tell someone in that situation that they shouldn't be concerned about their struggle.
Yeah, but there's a difference between pain and suffering. You know, I mean, I have to say, that people that I've known, and myself included, who have had to work multiple jobs and had to, you know, just to make ends meet. But it's really through spiritual work that actually makes it better. Mm-hmm. You know, you can focus, just like the, oh, it was my mother and my father that did this to me. You can focus on all the negativity about what it is, this state that you're in. But there needs to be another element to help you.
It seems like I hear this more from earlier generations, but they were talking about how they were poor when they were growing up, but they didn't really know it.
Yeah, my parents, my mother said that.
You know, and it felt like, yeah. If, when you hear that, you feel like they were happy while pursuing a more basic, maybe being more in touch with some of it. I don't want to make it sound better than it was.
I think that poverty, in this sense, would have to involve the feeling of envy.
Mm.
Simply being poor and having very little is not in itself being subject to a lord of materialism, for sure.
Envy.
So there's a feeling of material poverty, or there's a feeling of psychological poverty, or there's a feeling of spiritual poverty. In any case, it's feeling that you don't have enough, and you need something more to be yourself. Well, we better move on. Okay.
We'll
so,
never solve the world's problems.
Okay, so the second chapter here, Awakening Communities of Courage, and what I've said is that this one is about wealth. So for a while we're not going to follow what Galen wrote, and one of the reasons is that Galen spends more than half of the chapter talking about Tonglen and compassion practices, and we've, in the history of this group, spent a fair amount of time on it already, although you just walked in. But we've done several courses on that. And what I want to do is to try to address the subject of spiritual wealth using the same three categories, only I'd like to do it from the top down. In other words, this is kind of a new idea I have, so let's see how it works out. But I think it makes sense. And then it leads on to the next bit about the ecology issues. So what we want to talk about is spiritual wealth, psychological wealth, and material wealth. So spiritual wealth has to start with confidence that we are Buddha nature and do not have to look elsewhere. That was my sentence. Emily looked at it and said, well, the grammar's wrong. It should be confidence that we have Buddha nature. And I said, well, this is more awkward, but that implies that there's a me that has it. So it's actually, according to the teachings, we are Buddha nature. The self is a kind of manufactured thing. Does this make sense, and what are the consequences of spiritual wealth? abundance.
Abundance
of
generosity,
yeah.
Well, if you feel like you have enough, you're not like, I don't have to keep looking for more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I have enough food on my plate, I don't need to grab from other people and run to the store.
At the material level, yeah.
Right, but I'm saying in any way,
if
there's enough in me to be satisfied spiritually, I'm not constantly. If I would just meditate harder.
It's a tremendous freedom.
What?
Freedom.
Freedom, yeah. Freedom, okay.
It's lack of envy.
Yes, right. It's a sense that the world is already sacred. And I'm not separate from the world. If I'm not separate from the world, then the pain of the world and any pain in my body are of the same stuff. And one doesn't have to be preferred to the other. I know that's a tall order, but I want to get back to that presently. Another one I had was freedom from fear. And do you remember reading the Heart Sutra? Therefore, in emptiness, there is no fear. So, if you go back and look at that. Yes?
I only get this question because I'm so far from that level of wealth, but wouldn't it come with a different kind of fear? A fear of relapse? A fear of... because I would think someone with that kind of spiritual wealth would be envied and modeled by other people, and that would kind of bring the potential for vanity, for narcissism, and for kind of a re-engagement in these illusions.
You're a very deep thinker. Yeah, you got right to the essence of it. To really break through to that level means going through all those demons. There's a lot of work to be there, okay? And we all have those demons, the ones you're talking about, within us. And to actually realize that we are Buddha nature, and every religion has a word for it, by the way. It's not a, no one owns it. Is work, yeah. And work with all the demons that you just mentioned. That our own arrogance, that maybe we're getting somewhere. All sorts of levels.
And to me, it presents a paradox of being free from this fear, yet also having this great responsibility, which in turn could bring fear.
Oh, welcome. Okay. If you ever think that you're going to go to a Buddhist class and not be presented with a paradox, yeah, we're always pushed into the impossible, which is possible. One way to see that it's possible is to actually visit some realized teacher, okay? That's why on our website we have a list of some who we know about. And we actually sent flyers about one of them back here. It helps tremendously that there's actually someone who really has attained that, okay? To sit in front of such a person is a blessing. And you can't get it here. But you can get it by seeing a realized teacher. Yeah?
Yeah, I just was just thinking that, you know, the spiritual wealth is, you know, that you were just mentioning about seeing a great spiritual leader, you know, and being in their presence, how that affects you. And I know that we can affect others around us So just being power of example for other people so that, you know, they can see that, oh, you know what? Jesus, that person can do it. I can do it.
Exactly. Okay. So we may not be the type of lamps as Dzigar Khamphu Rinpoche or Anam Thubten, but we are lesser lamps, and we are lamps, yeah, right? There's something else I better move fast. I want to mention about fear, freedom from fear, which is a remarkable moment in American political history, which happened before I was born. In 1932, with the whole country in fear and depression and people camped out and people hungry, people living in shacks or not even shacks, and there was huge physical problems that many people had of just getting themselves fed and having a roof. And the man who was very wealthy, who had no such problem, became president. And the first thing he said was not, oh, these horrible things are happening, we've got to start working to fix them. He certainly did work to fix them. But what was the first thing he said?
The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
Yes. That is a remarkable instance of spiritual transmission. And I don't know when else that happened in American history, but it did. It's worth noting. And I don't think he was a perfect president, but he did do that. Okay, Galen mentions trust, that actually in our present domination by the three lords of materialism, we have less trust even than we did decades ago. We're getting more and more into their grip. I believe that's true. As we descend into a nation of fear and paranoia and no vision and being goaded into aggression and not being able to control that, trust is important. And we've already mentioned courage, compassion, and energy. If you look at one of these teachers, they don't get tired. Energy is always there. Because it's not limited by me and my limitation of I only have so much of a bank of energy, then I have to go protect myself. Okay, so what's the next one? Psychological wealth. The point I'm trying to make is that if we're going to overcome the lords of materialism and become wealthy, we better start with the wealth of the mind and let that flood down into finally how we deal with material wealth. So maybe no one agrees with me, I don't know, but I'm putting this forward.
But I think that's sort of your question about people who don't have a lot of stuff and are struggling. And sometimes you meet those people and they have some real spiritual depth that says, I'll be okay. You know, I may not have a lot, but I'm okay. Things will be okay. Things mm-hmm. will work out. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's hard to see how that's justified, but they somehow make a go of it, because they start there, and then the details of some of the other stuff isn't as...
Yeah. There's also no doubt that Cubans are happier than we are. They don't have political freedom, they have a lot of... Well, they don't have extremes of poverty of not being fed, but they have much less than we do, and they don't have political freedom, but they're happier. On the other hand, Russians are more depressed than we are. It's interesting to ponder these things and how they work out through these different levels. Okay, so within psychological wealth, I think education, useful education, meaningful education, education of values, education of art and craft, and education of good theories, all our forms of wealth. having a sense of art, having a sense of music, having a sense of how we handle our world, how we make things beautiful in our environment, I think are psychological wealth. So then what is material wealth?
Travels, and I think about those attachments, even down to a favorite shirt or dress or something. Like, I love this, and how. There's this other angel on one shoulder that says, "No, you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to be so attached to all those things." Okay, I'll try to imagine myself without them. Okay, I'll give them all. You know, no, don't give those things away. You love them. You know. So,
so we have a lot of work
material,
to do.
There's a, and I don't believe anyone who says, "Oh no, I could just easily just give it all." I'd be hard pressed to find someone.
Well, you can appreciate. I mean, I think the key here is appreciating. And then also thinking of others and wishing them to be comfortable in their life or to be happy. So in a way, it's not just about hoarding for yourself or reinforcing your own attachment. And it's not about giving it away either. I was listening, sometimes when I cook, I put on a headset and I play stuff on the internet. And Khandro Rinpoche was speaking about these teachings on, offering things to other people and then that is the practice and how the nuns would go around and give all this stuff. And then they want it all back. And she said, forget it, you know, you don't have to approach it that way. And you start small, you know, from letting go of the clinging. It's not having things. It's the clinging to that.
I thought it was like material wealth is like a connectedness to your own body, to your own physical self, and awareness of what your physical body is, or a Range Rover.
So surely it's enjoyment of things. And enjoyment of things, whether or not to the things that you own. You don't have to own the sky to enjoy it. You don't have to own the street you live on to want to make it beautiful.
Oh, and I often will say, my husband says, looks at some say, just because it's beautiful doesn't mean I have to own it. I also know I have bought things because they are.
Okay. I mean, it's not like you have to make yourself do something. It's not about that. It's understanding. It's working with the attachment to things and realizing in the end you're going to get it all. Give it all away.
Right.
The more things you're attached to, the harder it is.
That's true.
Okay.
That's one of the things I sort of got, because when I was younger, I lived in a rough neighborhood and was broken into a couple times in a year and lost a lot of the jewelry and stuff that I had. I don't want to ever get stuff that I'm so attached to that if I lose, I'll be devastated, and I don't want to have my memories so tied up in things.
Okay, I have some things that I really want to cover.
Okay.
Is it who has to walk out at 9 o'clock as opposed to 9:05? Absolutely. Oh, good, okay. So I do want to go. I want to read, just to finish this book, I want to show you where you tune right back into it, and then we're through with it. So I'm reading on the bottom of page 70. 170. This book ends with a vision of living within community as a powerful practice for uncovering and developing the innate goodness of a meditative path. That's not where I want to be. Okay. All too often, the path of spiritual awakening is divorced from the actual political turbulence, the immense suffering, both locally and globally, of our historical era. One might think that the profound spiritual instructions carefully passed down to us were primarily to ease our anxiety about ourselves, the teachings as spiritual antidepressants. Okay, so he's criticizing that view that the teachings are to make us feel good in any sense. And then he goes on to talk about all these various political movements of people who are concerned with doing good, fighting poverty, working on the environment. At the same time, these contemporary social and political movements, despite their worthy goals, seem cut off from the depth of inner experience, the dimension from which gentleness and celebration emerge. This book continues a tradition in which practicing awareness is a stepping stone to radical social change, the kind of change necessary to truly protect the earth. So I'm going to end reading in this book here, because that gave me an excuse to follow it up with my advertisements. Which you have to sit for.
We have to do the earth.
Okay, so we have some copies of these on the back, but you can get beautiful copies of both of these on our website. You'll find right on places to click, right on the home page of waltham-buddhist.org. By the way, there's a card there that'll give you, in case you don't remember, waltham-buddhist.org. So, two events. First one is this group, the next two meetings, which are September 11th and 18th. We're going to have a different sort of program. It's on this poster. We will not be using the cushions at all. We're going to set out lots of chairs because we're trying to invite lots of people. Please look at the poster. Invite friends. I hope you all come and that you welcome anyone who comes. So on the 11th, we will watch a video called Chasing Ice. It's a remarkable video about a man named, his name, James Balog, who, at great risk to his own life, took time-lapse photography to demonstrate what was happening in Greenland's ice, what was happening with glaciers in Alaska and other places, and to demonstrate how rapidly climate change is causing the loss of ice on Earth with lots of consequences, ranging from drought to rising sea levels. So we're just going to sit in a chair for about 5 minutes instead of meditating, and we aren't going to tell people how to do that. Then we'll show the movie, and then we will have a discussion about that. That's on the 11th. Then on the 18th, we'll be doing something a little different. This time we're going to be listening to, not a lot, but maybe 18 minutes of a talk by a woman named Joanna Macy. How many people know of her? Many don't. Okay. So I'm going to say a little bit about her. We're going to Joanna Macy is thoroughly trained as a Buddhist teacher. She went over to India probably around 1960, 61, I think, era, to work with Tibetan refugees who had fled Tibet and were coming over the Himalaya and living in refugee camps. So she started out by doing good, helping people physically. She met her teacher there, a Tibetan teacher. She became a highly accomplished Buddhist practitioner. She's very knowledgeable about Buddhism, yet she teaches in a very different way, sometimes called deep ecology. And one of the most remarkable things about how she teaches is that she can give out the whole thing without using a Buddhist word, so that what she says makes sense to Catholics, Buddhists, atheists, people who don't want to think about such things, Unitarians, Muslims, whatever. What she says is incredibly deep, and she has a program which sees working for the planet as a form of spiritual wealth, which is why I like her so much. And I've listed here, actually. Did I not?
The four-step cycle.
Yeah. The four-step cycle. This cycle is something you could go through in 5 minutes or 10 years, and it's not a once only. It's a continual renewing of your bodhisattva work, essentially. And she starts with coming from gratitude, just feeling the awe and miracle and gratitude for being alive and having our sense fields. Then honoring our pain for the world. And here is where the bodhisattva action doesn't flinch from the awful things happening everywhere. And she makes a special point of saying, if we feel bad in our body, if we feel we are psychologically bad, if we feel we are neurotic because we feel pain, don't let anyone persuade you that that's what's real. Your feeling pain means that you are a bodhisattva, although she doesn't have to use that word even. That we feel pain means that, like the bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, we are feeling for the planet. That's our pain, for everyone. We are identifying with the whole world, with other people, with other species, with the conditions of a planet being destroyed. And we can look at that because we are coming from gratitude. Then, the next issue is what we've called prajna, or insight, non-self, whatever, wisdom. Seeing a much greater perspective, because without that, we're overwhelmed by the awfulness of what we're seeing. When we take a bodhisattva vow, sentient beings are innumerable, I vow to save them all. It's impossible, and we have to take the vow to do it, and we take that vow with joy, because we're developing transcendental vision and energy. And then the last part is, what am I, in my particular situation, my body, my little self, as an aspect of that going to do? And it might not be a big deal, but it's part of something much more vast, and I have the courage to keep doing it. And I have the courage to start it without knowing if I can succeed. I have the courage to start it not knowing whether I'll even live long enough to see the result, which is something that all teachers have to do. So that's why I think she is an absolutely wonderful teacher. So we'll be doing this program on the 11th and the 18th. And the other sheet has to do with a different program, which is not part of the Buddhist meditation group. It's a set of teachings that on Joanna Macy's program, which follows the four steps. It's going to be given on the four Tuesdays of October, and the teachers for it are B. Fortin, who's a member of our church here, and myself, and any invited guests we have. And we are again trying to advertise this quite widely and let a lot of people know about it. So if you have any questions about any of those, we have a few posters back there, And the poster really is on the website. You can download it. You can email it to anyone. And it's much, they're much more beautiful than this when you see them in color.
I have a question about continuing sitting.
Yes.
So after the next two Thursdays, we'll come back into
yes.
the usual.
Good question. Yes, we're starting a new module. Emily basically has been doing most of the thinking about it, although I've been talking to her about it.
We'll be introducing a new book at that point. So starting something new. And furthering our studies. So we'll be in our usual format of sitting for 50 minutes and then having our class. So that'll start again at the end of September.
25th, I think? Is
25th.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I hope you'll come and enjoy this and invite people.
And act as a host also, you know, because people will be coming in, so it'll be nice to welcome them. Invite them, yes.
Yeah, in this room, but no cushions.
Buddhism without cushions.
Buddhism without cushions.
Buddhism in the world.
Okay, time to get off your cushions. So thank you very much.
And dedicate for merit.
We'll dedicate for merit. And then,
do that first.
Yeah, I'm going to turn this.